From Pacifica Radio, KPFT 90.1 Houston, this is Open Journal in Exile. Open Journal is the Houston community magazine of the airwaves. Join us as Duane Bradley and Stephanie Coleman explore the wonder that is the Petro Metro and the people who make it happen. And now from our temporary, socially distanced, alternative studios in exile, somewhere in the greater Houston area, this is Open Journal in Exile. Let the conversation begin.
Yes, yes, yes. Welcome aboard. You are tuned in to Open Journal on Pacifica Radio KPFT, the Mighty 90. Listener-sponsored and commercial-free since March 1st of 1970. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for tuning in. And thanks for your support. It is Monday, September 28th, 2020. Welcome to fall. I'm Duane Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. In this special edition of Open Journal in Exile, we'll be continuing our wonderful discussion on race with Cherry Steinwender of the Center for the Healing of Racism, along with local activist and author of the book, America's Unholy Ghosts, The Racist Roots of Our Faith and Politics, with Joel Edward Goza. As always, this is an experiment in community conversation, and we welcome your feedback, opinions, and suggestions via Twitter, and Facebook, hashtag KPFTOJ, or subscribe to our podcast, KPFTOJ. We do read more than a few characters, and for those who'd like to say more, join us at openjournal@kpft.org with an email.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we will be joining Joel and Cherry in just a moment, but you know, we are still in mourning over the recent passing of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And sadly, that passing, while being honored by many and mourned by not a few, has, as with too many things in our culture these days, become politicized.
Yeah.
So we're witnessing that ongoing drama. When we really, I think, ought more, and I'm assuming most of you listening to this program are more in the grieving stage, and if anything, this politicizing of her passing is just a cause for more concern, while we ought to be in that period of mourning the passing of such a giant, the notorious RBG, and we... send our prayers and condolences to her family, and it's been a sad week. On top of having, you know, another dowsing for days and days of flooded roads and Houston being underwater for most of the past week, and all of that attendant mess. Then we have the big mess that's happening all around the country with the politics and the election and what's going to happen to my vote and where's my mail.
Right.
And how dare they do this? And even to the point of the president politicizing it and saying, oh, yeah, they say that her daughter said her last wishes expressed were that she would not have this seat filled until after the installation of the next president. Oh, that's just a Democratic talking point. They forced her to say it or they made it up. And, you know, again, it's just another disturbing step down this road of disturbance that we live on now.
Mm-hmm. No, it definitely is. I mean, we are Houstonians. We're local. We're here with you. And I think, as Duane is saying, like the trauma and the drama of all of this can be a bit much when you begin to pile and pile and pile. And so it is a lot to say here, not just today on this call, but on this station, that this is a place for real conversations, fair news, fair discussions, complex dialogue about some of these issues, because it becomes a bit much sorting through the spin and the deception and the mythology of what is now called news. So, you know, as always, we thank you for your support and continued support, because that is what we do this for, I think, in order to have real meaningful conversations that help us navigate all of these troubling times. Mm-hmm. Not just to navigate them, but ideally to get out of them, right? Isn't that the goal?
Right.
We want to be better than where we were and, you know, closer to where we wanted to be. We want to get better and together, as always, with our not just our politics, but our health.
Right.
How can we continue to do that?
Well, not only do we want to participate and motivate on that City of Houston Health Department program, Better Together, because we are indeed better when we work together. I see that on a granular level. My wife and I are better when we're together. We get more work done. We support each other. 1 + 1 doesn't just equal 2 in that respect. It equals 3+, you know, and that kind of translates over to the greater community, the larger family that is all of us here in the Petro Metro and beyond, wherever you might be tuning in to this broadcast from. So remember that, and also remember that KPFT is a free service, a public service. None of us producing these programs derive a financial benefit from anything. Indeed, we actually spend money producing these things.
Yeah.
And we are paying members to this radio station, as we hope you are. And if you are waiting to be asked, well, then I'll ask. How about joining us? You know, a simple tap on the donate button. It's a tip jar there at kpft.org. Drop a few dollars into that and earmark it to Open Journal. That would mean a lot to us personally. It would also say something to the folks in management at KPFT that this is a valuable part of this community resource. You can also call the station at 713-526-5738-526-KPFT. There's no one there. The station has basically been locked down since the last part of March. There's no staff there. There's nobody in the studio. The phone line will go to a service, and those folks will walk you through your donation and maybe offer you a t-shirt or a tote bag or a keychain or some tchotchke of some sort that might make you feel good about what you did. But honestly, the thing that will make you feel the best about what you did is just the doing of it. And then you'll suddenly feel different every time you listen to the radio from now on. I know that because it happened to me back a few years ago, and it can happen to you too. So thanks to those of you who totally understand what I'm saying and have joined in that operation over the many, many years. Now, 51st year in service to the Upper Texas Gulf Coast, KPFT is an institution. Not that we need to be institutionalized, but we are an integral part of the community because we bring the community together. We build bridges of connectivity rather than walls of separation, which too many in our culture seem hell-bent on doing at this point in time. So there you have it. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Dwayne Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. Can our current racial and ethnic divide be turned around? Recent events surrounding the police murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and too many others brought many thousands to the street. The Black Lives Movement has galvanized this moment. Major sports teams have even expressed support as they have re-entered the public arena. Cherry Steinwender is founder and co-director of the Houston-based Center for the Healing of Racism, which is dedicated to the healing of racism through education and empowerment since 1989. Joel Goza is a Houston-based writer, minister, and advocate. His first book, America's Unholy Ghosts, The Racist Roots of Our Faith and Politics, is an examination of the religious and secular thinkers who inspired our founding fathers and leaders' addiction to racist and classist ideas. Cherry and the Center for the Healing of Racism will be hosting Joel on a special Zoom conversation this coming Wednesday, September 30th, from 6 to 8 p.m. Cherry, Joel, thanks for joining us again, and welcome to Open Journal to continue these important conversations.
Thank you so much, Stephanie and Dwayne. It is wonderful to return. And I think I really need to let you know that I have been on KPFT ever since 1990. So wow. That's a long time. I have a long history with you guys, even though Dwayne and Stephanie wasn't on at that time, but I've been interviewed by many people on KPFT, and I think your listening audience need to know that.
Yes, yes, definitely. Absolutely. You should interview us. No, but I think it's wonderful, and it's wonderful that you have been fighting the good fight and holding the torch on these issues so that we can continue to have a voice to be amplified, because we would hate for that flame to grow dim and definitely do not want it to go out. So, you know, thank you for all the work that you've done. Keeping a torch lit so Joel Gozas can come and be a part of
it. It is good to be here and to listen to another interview with Sherry. So I'm excited to be with the team today.
That's great.
To be back.
Well, you know, looking back at our original framing question we first posed when we brought the two of you together with us on this forum back at the beginning of the summer, that question was, can our current racial and ethnic divide be turned around? Has anything changed to alter how you have felt about it then and re-expressed when we had you in last here in mid-July or so, bringing you back here at the end of September, the beginning of the fall after a couple of summer visits? Sherry, how do you feel?
Well, let me first say that I truly believe that it can be changed around. And I want to use a quote that I've used, and I've been using it for 30 years, and that is, we are not doomed to repeat the mistakes of the past. I truly believe that. But I believe the only way we're going to get out of this mess, it's going to take a lot of hard work. We are in a marathon in this country, not a sprint. And so what is different? What is so different now when you have head of organizations emailing or calling the center wanting to put the top people through this conversation first? It's not the individuals that's with the organizations. Now you're working with the top people where decisions and policies are being made. That's different than before the murder of George Floyd. The other thing that is different, I am 100% sure, because people have said this to me, when people are now Googling workshops for their companies, instead of Googling multiculturalism and diversity workshops, they're really Googling racism. That's different. And whenever I get a call or email, I ask that question, what did you Google? So I want to let you know, before all of this happened with George Floyd, we were still the same old business, the same old tired song that people were sick of, multiculturalism and diversity and inclusion training. So now they're using what it really is, racism.
Very interesting.
Joel, how have things transpired for you in the several months since our last visit in relation to that opening frame?
Well, I think, you know, the since our last visit, I have been reading a lot of people very much like Sherry. So, you know, as I had mentioned previously, my next book is on reparations. And I have been reading a lot from Frederick Douglass, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois, Ida B. Wells. And one of the things that is always shocking to me reading the folks is the type of poignant hope that characterized their work, their lives, their writings. And it was a hope, but it wasn't always an optimistic hope. You know, so there is a difference between optimism and hope for change. And I think what the Black activist tradition has always understood is that the future is what we're creating, that the future is not predetermined, but it is shaped by the type of choices that we make today. And so there is kind of a myth out there of American exceptionalism that somehow we can rise above our choices and not pay the price for our choices, that we will be immune from the mistakes that we make. And when I read Du Bois and Wells and Frederick Douglass, they don't believe that. They believe that we will pay the price for the choices that we make, but they know that American history is not predetermined. And as Sherry said, we do not have to repeat the same mistakes of the past. And I think the question becomes is, what are we ready to learn from the mistakes that we have made in the past and refuse to repeat them? You know, one of the deep concerns I have is that as an American people, we really don't know our history. Mm-hmm. We don't understand how deep the mistakes are that we have made and how much the price that we've paid in the lives of fathers and mothers and sisters and brothers for our addiction to white supremacy. The price that we have paid is more than what can ever be calculated. And so, do I believe things can change? I absolutely do believe things can change. And I believe in the power of those who are angry and lean into democracy for all it's worth. And yet, I think that when we think about hope, we also have to think about the long term and never to allow short-term losses or short-term victories to fundamentally impact what our commitments need to be in order to begin building an anti-racist America.
Mm-hmm. And with that said, Joel, when you talk about not really giving any thought to our losses, you know, and that's very interesting because you named several things. But one of the things I want to put into the equation, and first of all, let me say, I don't say anything I don't believe. When we set this organization up, and we learned firsthand that how many white people have been hurt around racism, when we had white people sitting at the table and dared to look within to be able to know how they have been hurt around racism. You see, the thing of it is, in these conversations, we don't bring that to the table often enough to give white people an opportunity to really go within, to be able to see that they have been damaged and hurt around racism as well. And what have you lost? And for so many white people, you've really lost your sense of humanity. Mm-hmm. For a lot of white people, what have you lost? Believing the myth of a lot of the education that you receive, if it's not a myth, was a doggone lie. When you say, and then to walk around so proudly, you know, with that education held up high, when a whole lot of it wasn't the truth anyway. And to even look at James Loyd, when he wrote the book, Lies My Teachers Told. But there is another cost to all of this, and that's the cost of the environment. Mm-hmm. Where Native people, if we had have just listened to the indigenous people of this country, we wouldn't be in the mess we having within the West with all of those fires and all of the other things, like all of this massive flooding in Houston, all of these hurt. You know, so it's a loss to the environment. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about this, what we have lost, and my question is, I'm going to keep on walking and I'm keep on talking and I'm going to keep on screaming it from the mountaintop, because somebody got to hear it and somebody got to keep the torch burning. But you, Joel, and your work, but also that little child I just saw on the screen. See, we got to keep on walking and keep on talking because I refuse to roll over and play dead.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, I think one of the unique challenges that you mentioned, and one of the strange accomplishments in the short time and long time since we both have, or we've all spoken, you do say that you see some sense of measurable change in attitude and perspective, Cherry, that you've sort of felt a change. How much of that do you think is because these deaths became a public conversation? How much do you think it is because the protests hit the pocketbooks economically of the cities? How much do you think it's because COVID added on to the economic piece? Or does it matter why? Is it just good that it's happening?
Well, let me say, really, for me, it really doesn't matter why. Mm-hmm. You know, let's look at, see, I've been doing this for 31 years, Stephanie. Mm-hmm. And the only reason that I have been around for 31 years, enough people believed in, enough people showed up, enough people supported the organization financially with their time, commitment, and everything else. So I have to give kudos to all of those people that kept us going for 30 years. And now in the 31st year, we have all of the things that you just mentioned. And you know, it really doesn't matter why. You know, let's look at little children. You know, it really doesn't matter whether it's the Easter Bunny or Santa Claus bringing the doggone presents.
Right.
They just happy to get the presents. So I will say right now, it really doesn't matter why, because what I am seeing, let me tell you, the joy every time I see the sports figures taking a knee, the immense joy that I feel, the joy that I felt when they walked off the court and refused to play, the joy that I felt. And you see, make no mistake about it. Once you've seen this, once you've heard this, you can't pretend that you didn't. And I really feel, I go back to what I said before, really doesn't matter why.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's powerful. Joel, as you think about this continued conversation and the systematic future of racism, we see the attitude shifting in behavior. What are your thoughts on the institutional change in terms of how it's structured? And what that might look like in the future.
Well, you know, it's interesting that, you know, we're here on this Zoom call, and in one of my photos on when I'm not on Zoom is my son, which what Sherry was referencing earlier, and he has this fear stare on his face. But it was interesting that Sherry mentioned him, because when on my book on reparations, it begins with a letter to my children. And it begins about the responsibility that we have in order to own our history so that we may begin writing a different future. And, you know, one of the things, you know, that Douglass said is Douglass was very formed by the abolitionist tradition, and the abolitionist tradition was ready to burn up the Constitution, this, that, or the other. And what Frederick Douglass said as he looked to the future is he says, if you look at the preamble of the Constitution, of pursuing the common good, of ensuring domestic tranquility, if we can line the laws of our land in order to do that work, we can have a fundamentally different future. Mm-hmm. If we can have an economy that bases its, that judges itself off of the most vulnerable among us, we can have a strong economy. You know, one of the ironic things with, the American economy today is that they say that we're the richest nation in the world, and yet we have some of the most poor people in the world as mm-hmm. well. The largest percentage of poor people of any industrialized nation. There are ways of thinking and ways of being that we have inhabited for so long that we have forgotten that there are other ways. But there are different ways of being if we can, and I want to speak very specifically, because I don't want to sound, you know, highfalutin. We bought into the lie that our government couldn't do any good and didn't need to provide a safety net for folks. That's a lie we can reject. And we can start putting people into office who believe that government can care for people. We believe that only radical inequality would provide a healthy economic base, only to find out that even if you study capitalism itself, the very founder of capitalism, Adam Smith, believed that only equity can provide us the foundation for our lives together so that we can thrive. But when we look to the future, there's a whole lot of big assumptions that we have that we had got to begin challenging. There was a great book put out called The Immunity to Change, and it was really over personal development. And what it said is that, you know, people will often have a lot of big assumptions that they have bought into so deeply that they refuse to really go through the painful change in order to get to the future that they want. And so if we say that we want an anti-racist future, what are some of the assumptions that we can start questioning and some of the ways of thinking that we have held on to for so long that we can begin rewriting in order to start making a better future for our children today? And these are some of the things I think that we really have to wrestle with.
Mm-hmm. You are tuned to Pacifica Radio. This is the Open Journal program. We thank you for joining us on this special edition. We are visiting with Cherry Steinwender from the Center for the Healing of Racism and local author, activist, Joel Edward Goza. We thank you for your support, and we appreciate you being there. I'm Dwayne Bradley with Stephanie Coleman. Cherry, I was wondering, we mentioned that you guys, you and Joel, will be teaming up here in just a couple days to essentially Zoom an evening based on his book, America's Unholy Ghosts, The Racist Roots of Our Faith and Politics. How did that come about? And can you share a little bit of how that will go in a couple days here?
Well, I hope his wife will never hear this program, because I want to tell you how I fell in love with him. It was at St. Philip's Church, right off of 610 in San Felipe, mm-hmm. where he was invited to talk about the book, The Unholy Ghost. And it blew my mind. So I just want to let you know that's how we first met. What I really truly feel, we need more Joels. We need more white males that can step up and tell the truth. Because, see, I know very well, because of the sexism in this country, that if white women go out and say that, it doesn't have the same, it doesn't land the same way as if a white male step up and say it. One of the things I'll never forget in his talk, he talked about the neighborhood that he moved into and how long he's been there. And to me, that takes a amount of bravery. You see, my husband of 39 years, we've been living in an all-black neighborhood for 37 years. But you see, my husband was brought to this neighborhood out of love. He was in love with me, and he was following me anywhere I go. But the thing of it is, Job had a choice. He had a choice of where to live. You see, it's these things. These are the type of people that I always want to surround myself around, because not only do they educate me, because when I'm out there speaking about racism, I have to always talk about white people that have resisted the current trend, past and present. When you talked about Frederick Douglass, one of the things that Frederick Douglass was aligned closely with was William Lloyd Garrison, an abolitionist. William Lloyd Garrison had a choice, and he made the choice to stay the course for 40 years. This white man went 40 years until the Emancipation Proclamation was signed. This man at time couldn't even feed his 8 children. He really had to depend on friends and family and other abolitionists to feed his children. At any given time, this man could have quit and said, hell, I'm going to make some money. But for 40 years, he stayed the course. This is who Frederick Douglass surrounded himself around. People with substance. People that's willing to fight the tough fight. People that's willing to go the distance. So I look forward. I'm really looking forward to doing more with Joel, because I believe in him. And I hope to sell a lot of books on
Wow, right.
Because that's also our problem. We're ignorant. Mm-hmm. Too many of us are ignorant to what really happened in this country.
Well, I'm going to make my wife listen to that, Sherry. I can't tell you how, you know, I was being humorous, but I don't want to lose how honored I am to be with you and to be able to work alongside of you. It's, you know, one of the honors of my life for sure.
Well, I'm so glad I didn't give my home address.
Hilarious.
Well, Cherry, Joel, it's an honor for all of us mm-hmm. on Open Journal and the folks at KPFT to have both of you, not just as guests, but as friends, as colleagues, and co-warriors in this struggle. Yeah. And I wanted to ask you, Joel, to follow up by maybe dipping into this a little about the intersection of racism, classism, and I'll throw sexism into the mix, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it is all part of the cocktail. You know, one of the things, you know, we were just talking about Frederick Douglass, but Frederick Douglass was a very committed feminist and fought very hard for women's rights. But when you had when we had America's founding, America's founding is based off the Enlightenment. And one of the things that happens in the Enlightenment in a very unique way is that it makes white men the center of the world. And it makes particularly rich white men the center of the world. And religion changes. And so instead of Jesus being a poor Palestinian Jew, he becomes more crafted into the image of the rich white man. And the rich white man starts becoming what the ideal of humanity is perceived to be. And it happened very intentionally. And it changed world history, and it was very formative for our culture in very profound ways. You know, one of the things that becomes interesting in the Enlightenment, you have these things, these white wigs, that those with power and prestige start wearing. And those wigs were much more than a fashion statement for these men. It was the embodiment of what prestige looked like, what authority looked like. And, you know, way back when in Christianity, when we saw people who were poor and broken, Christians thought that they were seeing Jesus, because that's what Jesus said that he was like. But before too long, we develop a culture to where you have a Thomas Jefferson's Bible, for instance. And Thomas Jefferson starts taking out everything that doesn't look like a Virginian aristocrat from the story of Jesus, and intentionally starts molding the Christian faith and the worldview of America and the larger Western world to harmonize with classism and sexism in very profound ways.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've always, you know, as we talk about our tomorrow and just sort of how these concepts and ideas become constructed and embraced, for 2020, which has been quite a unique year, and as we consider moving forward, how is it as intentional as just sitting down and writing the future vision? Is it almost as easy as sitting down in a reverse behavior of that?
I actually think that that is not the way that the future can be written. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that became very intentional in this kind of context that we're talking about is killing relationships. Mm-hmm. That what was important for people like Thomas Jefferson, for people of the Enlightenment, for the founders of America, was always having the right answers, but never having the right relationships. Mm-hmm. And when we look at where we're at in 2020, it is not that we lack answers to how to address our problems, but we lack the type of relationships that social change always has to entail. And so it is not enough for white folks to find the right answers. Mm-hmm. You know, because mm-hmm. the type of ignorance that white folks like myself have is a very deeply relational ignorance. You know, it is one thing to know the stats of lynching, but you go and you read Ida B. Wells' work, she's going to tell you the names. She's going to tell you the stories. She had relationships with these victims, mm-hmm. which made her work very different than what it would have been otherwise. Mm-hmm. So it is not simply just... Is public policy huge? Absolutely, public policy is huge. Writing public policy well, is that huge? Yes, that is huge. But before we can have kind of three-dimensional thinking, we have to have a life of three-dimensional relationships. Mm-hmm. To where, you know, one of the things that Sherry said is that white folks have lost their humanity. And I think if people ask me what white supremacy has cost us, I mean, that would be the very first thing that I would say is that white people have lost their humanity. And one of the heartbreaking things, you know, there has been a lot of ink spilled talking about, white evangelicalism and Donald Trump. And for so many, it was a shocking, shocking thing that white evangelicals were willing to support Donald Trump. But one of the things I find very consistent between our president and white evangelicals for all of their differences is the refusal to truly empathize with people who are outside of their bubble, to truly know people who are outside of their bubble. And one of the historical roles of segregation was to make transformative relationships impossible, to make impossible the relationships between a William Lloyd Garrison and a Frederick Douglass, to make impossible the relationships between a Sherry Steinwinder and a Joel Goza, between Dwayne Bradley and Stephanie Coleman. And so it is not about simply getting into a room and creating the right answers. The question becomes is how do we become the type of people who can have the relationships that we need to bring about the changes that we want for our children.
That's beautiful.
That is something very interesting. I don't know why this came into my mind, but I know it was probably 31 years ago attending a workshop. And in this workshop, the facilitator divided the group. And she said, everybody that identifies as a person of color would go into the left side of the room. And everybody that self-identify as white, European, to go into the other side of the room. And in the room, she walked us through an exercise. And in the exercise, she noticed that in the one side of the room where people that identified as white, it was so quiet and it was so sterile. But in that other room with all the people of color, we were having a good time and we were singing songs and we were doing a lot of things. And when she brought us back together, the natural curiosity is, what did y'all do in each one of those rooms? And it's like the people of European descent could hear the laughter and the joy and the singing and the clapping, and they were just sterile and quiet. And it also brings to mind what you said, Joel, and in doing this, and just an exercise, but it taught a very profound lesson that of how so many white people over the years of doing this have said they don't have a culture. They don't have a culture. And so there is a type of envy that I've heard spoken, that people of color, they have all these cultural things and foods and songs and whatever. But what they fail to realize that their ancestors gave up their cultural roots and cultural orientation to identify as white. So if you say white, there's no white culture. But if they could return back to the country of origin, there are all types of cultures and expressions and music and dance and clothing and language. And so the bottom line is that when your ancestors gave up all of that, and now the only thing you're left with, I'm white, what the hell does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Well, that's a deep one, Cherry, because it's got me running thought tracks hither and thither, and we could do whole shows just running down different ideas on that. As someone who struggled growing up as a white man, but I never thought of myself as white because I grew up Irish Catholic, and both of those were people who were suspicioned by the white people in charge. So that made that whole thing a little different. I was told that I was black Irish because I don't look Irish. I'm not.
Right. And in fact, you had to become white. You see, the people from Ireland wasn't white when they landed here. You had to be given that classification. But let me say to you how real this thing is. I want to tell you something very personal. I'm telling my husband's business now, okay? My husband came to the United States on holiday. My husband did not speak English at all. My husband lived with people from Switzerland, and they were determined that they were going to make him a white man. Because my husband would say to you over and over again, if you ever called him white, he would tell you, I'm not white. And people couldn't understand that. But in his country of origin, in Austria, nobody was called white. That wasn't a classification. But in order to make him white into this country, in order to align with other people that look like him, it's almost like us going to us have hearing a sermon every single day. And within this sermon, they are teaching him who to be afraid of, who not to trust. I mean, they gave him this lesson every day. If a person of color walked by their house, they would make him come to the window and look out and say, you see, this is the people that's going to do all these bad things to you. So they were training my husband to be a white male. Well, you see, the training didn't take. He married me, didn't it? But the bottom line is how do you take people from countries that with no classification as whiteness, and they come to the United States? There's a way. And then you have to take on group mentality for a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And so you have to call all these other people all these dirty names and everything else and all these ethnic groups. So even my husband's brother called him up one day and said, I want to tell you a joke. And my husband said, if this joke that you're about to tell me will hurt or offend any group of people other than white, then don't tell me the joke. Then my husband said, well, I tell you what, why don't you use you and people that look like you as the butt of the joke? Then his brother said, well, the joke wouldn't work. So my husband said, well, don't tell it to me then. You have to be strong to be able to offset everything that comes at you all the time. Not every now and then, all the time.
Cherry Steinwender from the Center for the Healing of Racism, along with author Joel Goza, joining us on this special edition of Open Journal in Exile. We thank you for tuning in and sharing this time with us. I'm Dwayne Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. You know, as we look at effective change and begin to shape, I think Joel Goza, as you were talking about what we can script and what we need to build as a way of living, not as a sort of written construct. Sort of asking you both, what does that effective change look like? What would real reparations look like? How does that sustain? How long does that last? What is the growth of the notion of having a sort of perfect nation? And how do we frame it and how do we sustain it?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So like when you look at the work of reparations, you know, one of the things, the person who put it on the radar, you know, over the last 10 years or so, more than anybody else, is probably Ta-Nehisi Coates. And he wrote an article for The Atlantic, I believe it was in 2014, that he wrote his article on reparations. Now, people have been doing the work for a long time. John Conyers had been bringing it before Congress every year since 1988, and was continuing to bring it before Congress when Coates wrote his piece. But one of the things that is critical for Coates is that, you know, the work of reparations, part of the role is it's forming a completely different national consciousness by delving deeply into the truths of the racial violence that has underwritten our society. And that type of work is going to be a lifetime of work in order to have the type of self-understanding that we would have in order to begin building the nation that we want. And so if you said, for instance, you know, what is one component that is necessary of a life of integrity? I think one of the things that people would want to say is self-awareness. You know, part of the work of reparations is admitting that we are a racially oblivious people, and we must start paying the price of developing the type of awareness that is necessary in order to start undertaking the work. How everything happens, I believe, is a one step at a time type deal. You know, I had a friend who made three commitments that changed his life, and it changed the life of his family. He said that we are going to go be living in a community where we're the minority. Our children are going to go to a school where they're the minority, and we're going to go to a church where we're the minority. And those three commitments ended up writing a very different life for him and his children than what he would have before he made those commitments. It was life changing. You know, my wife and I, we have our own commitments of what we do for our family and how we live our life. And one of the things I think that is really important during this time is to take our choices off of autopilot and to begin living much more intentionally. You know, Sherry was talking about this process of how Dwayne and I became white. And what was so important was convincing people of certain convictions and having them believe those convictions before they were ever investigated. And so what does it mean to have a type of life that intentionally questions the type of assumptions that shaped our history, that shaped the worldview that was passed on to us? The challenging aspect is that there are no simple answers. But in a world without simple answers, we can begin making very intentional choices of how we live our lives, of who we vote for, of who we learn from. You know, Sherry, if we taught American history through the lens of Frederick Douglass and David Walker and Ida B. Wells, what type of national consciousness would our children develop if they were learning from Baldwin rather than Ronald Reagan, for instance? There are things that are in our power that we can do. We are not powerless in the face of our history. But the work has to be intentional.
I'm reminded, just listening to what you said, I'm reminded of a man by the name of David Potter. David Potter died about 4 years ago. But this was a tenured professor at the University of Massachusetts. And it hit him one day that as a human being, as a white male, he wasn't really learning anything at all because all of the people that he surrounded himself was also white males, tenured professors, same income, same neighborhood, same everything. And when that hit him, he went to Nepal and he studied with the Dalai Lama. And when he came back intentionally, he surrounded himself with all women of color. And then after so many years and I met him, he said, everything that I've ever learned now who I am, I got for women of color. He hit the nail on the head. You keep running around in the same circle. You take on group mentality and y'all ain't learning nothing. So I have to say that. Yeah. But what we are doing right now, and I, before the end, the workshops that we are doing now is called, for 2 hours by Zoom, A Look at Our Racial Conditioning. And we take people from the baby, from an infant to where they are now, of how they got set up to play this us and them, why we're still playing out. And we look at all of those things and have them do their own, you know, exploration and taking a journey within. And we only ask them to go in to see how they got set up to play out this us and them in this country.
Yeah. And it's a painful process, you know, I mean, because I had to go through a process where I realized most of what I believed was based off of at best half truths and most of the times complete lies. Mm-hmm. And that process is a very difficult one to reestablish an identity when one identity has been taken from you. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's always just so amazing to have these conversations. And we just really appreciate the honesty and the candor, because I think that is one, an example for our listeners and for ourselves to know, in a world of sort of watching your words or understanding the balance of what it is to have a challenging conversation without having a hurtful or intentionally spiteful conversation. And, you know, I think with your workshops and your books and your teaching and your talking, that can help people understand that it's not that you don't have the conversations. It says with any engagement, there are methodologies or just being honest and candid and not meaning to hurt, but really looking to, you know, converse about it and explore. How would you recommend, or how do you see for our listeners that they continue this dialogue and know how you navigate when you've hit a nerve with yourself, let alone your nerve, a nerve with the person who you're really looking to get clarity through.
Well, let me say first of all that we started these conversations creating spaces that's respectful, mm-hmm. that's loving spaces, that it's almost like taking the Hippocratic oath to do no harm. Mm. And so it's no way in the world we can damage people in these circles intentionally, viciously, and have healing in our name. Now mm-hmm. just think about that. That's never going to happen if we went about it in a way that's totally contrary to mm-hmm. healing racism. But we will have these conversations, and the way that we frame it is that we are looking at our racial conditioning, and we've all been conditioned.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think, when I think about those questions, I think that that question right there really gets to the heart of the matter. And it's one of those things where I find myself finding a spiritual answer. When I look at MLK, for instance, he knew what his commitment was before he ever engaged, and what his commitment was to be nonviolent and to be someone who loves. And he wouldn't allow any racist to break that commitment for him. And as we try to recover our humanity, I think that this is what white liberals really struggle with, to be quite frankly, is that most white liberals have not committed to be people who are love and nothing more than love. Sometimes we have more pride in being right than being in kind and than being right. But from King's tradition, he believed that God is love and that people are made in God's image. And that is, what he continued to aim for. Even when it felt impossible, which doesn't mean that there wasn't anger, wasn't a lot of other things that he wrestled with. But I think that he shows us an example, of how to be completely committed to the truth, to be completely committed to clarity, because what he said was scathing. What he said was absolutely scathing, and yet he was completely committed to love at the end of the day. The people that have changed my life were always those who were ready to love me right where I was at. It wasn't those who were ready to love me once I was on the right side of the ideological divide. Once I was a mirror image of them. And yet, as I say that, I know how hard in my own life that this has been proven, particularly over the last few years, of being committed to love and committed to truth and committed to kindness. It is a very costly growing up that I think most of us are still in the process of. But at least knowing what the aim is, I think, can be helpful.
We've been hearing a lot recently, more than ever, about Black Lives Matter. What is it with some people, and I'll just particularize it and say white people, who need to express that all lives matter and just can't accept that Black Lives Matter can't be something without saying, well, all life matters? Well, sure it does. Why can't some people seem to accept Black Lives Matter without having to lard it over with all this other?
Joel said something very, very, very important. And I think that's the answer to all of it. Because one of the things that I recognize, if it's not love, it's fear. Mm-hmm. So here, white people, I'm going to use what you said, Dwayne, that have to come up with this, all these other different type of lives matter. I think there is a fear that if you start saying Black Lives Matter in the whole country, buy into that, there is a fear of losing something. Maybe I'm going to lose that my life doesn't matter as much. So if it ain't love, it's fear. And I think there is a fear component to a whole lot of this that we are seeing, a whole lot of this contention, a whole lot of this us and them mentality. If it ain't love, if I don't love you, Dwayne, I'm going to fear you.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree with that. When you're white, you know that life is hard. If you get your heart broken, if you're white, that hurts. If you lose your child and you're white, that hurts. And so you know what, to some extent, what life is, and you know the value of your life. But if that is combined with a lack of empathy for Black suffering is simply different in this nation. Black life, it goes against the grain of who our nation privileges. And if we can't empathize with that, and if we know our own humanity, then we end up getting defensive. We do not have the empathy that is required at this point to bring down our walls, to go through life, even with white privilege. It's costly, you know, it's costly. And yet, if my humanity hasn't allowed me to empathize with those who are different, then what I've got to do is point the spotlight on the realities of my own life and not understand how all the privileges that I've been raised with, that I've learned to take for granted. And so it is using a truth in a very deceitful way that does very demonic work. And, you know, one of the great dangers is that, you know, one of the things, you know, Augustine always talked about is how what sin is it's misappropriated love. You know, it's love aimed in the wrong direction. And when you look at all life matters, when you look at white supremacy itself, it is generally love aimed in the wrong direction because of what Sherry talked about of fears, of insecurities, of, you know, our own obliviousness.
Well, I choose love and faith over fear. I'm so happy to have both of you on this special edition of The Open Journal. There is a program this coming Wednesday night from 6 to 8 p.m. People can find more information through the website centerhealingracism.org or also joeledwardgoza.com. That's G-O-Z-A, joeledwardgoza.com. I want to continue.
I know. I do.
I'll let me just say this. I very deeply appreciate your intelligence, your heart, your spirit, your willingness to be true. We thank you for joining us on this special edition of Open Journal.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your support and love. I'm Dwayne Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. Programs are available at kpft.org, and please subscribe to our podcast, KPFT OJ. We are a dedicated volunteer production staff, including Ramblin' Rick Campbell, Susan Phillips, and Maverick. Open Journal theme music is provided by Kevin McLeod. Join us next week on Open Journal for more great conversations, and thank you for your support.
As always, we'd like to leave you with a thought to carry you through the week. This comes from Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who said, "I try to teach through my opinions, through my speeches, how wrong it is to judge people on the basis of what they look like, color of their skin, whether they're men or women." Take care of each other.